So I'm going to talk about an idea that we have and entitle it From Divestment to Investment. Now, it plays on an idea that occurred about 30 years ago, and many of you will remember that following the Soweto uprising of 1976, students on campuses across the United States began a wide range of protest activities, with their aim being the divestment of South African-related investments held by their school endowments. Between 1977 and 1988, 155 educational institutions agreed to divest, and it made a huge impact on the commitment and the understanding of what it would take to make a difference in apartheid. One might conclude that students in the divestment movement 30 years ago provided everyone, classmates, teachers, parents, and of course school administrative officials, some very valuable lessons in economics and in ethics. My idea is to ask today's students to offer a refresher course in these subjects, but one with a broader aim of ending global poverty. Instead of a divestment movement, let's make it an investment movement. University endowments are massive. Now, while the United States economy may be in the doldrums, college and university endowments are doing great. According to the source that collects this information, 76 institutions of higher learning had endowments exceeding $1 billion in the year 2007. The top university topped out at $34 billion in their total endowment. This entire group held an endowment of funds of more than $41 billion, and that's up by 18% over what it was in 2006. So these endowments, while they obviously are needed for educational purposes, are huge and growing and could be deployed in ways that could make a difference in ending global poverty. What if the colleges and universities in our nations decided to take just a small fraction of their endowment and devote those funds to helping the nearly 3 billion people who are living on less than $2 a day? We could choose an amount like the 0.7 tenths of a percent of 1%, or 0.7%. That's the percent of GDP that the richest nations around the world have agreed to commit to overseas development. So if universities were willing to give 0.7%, that's less than 1%, towards ending global poverty, that would be about $3 billion a year. So Would $3 billion a year make a difference? You bet. For only $60 million, you can provide birthing kits that will enable 1 million women to have safe and clean deliveries. Investing $50 million would send 1 million Afghan children, including girls, to school for a year. A mere $20 million would provide basic vaccines and supplies that could immunize 1 million children against the 6 common childhood diseases. What will we do with this tiny fraction of the university endowment funds? One, who would decide? Should we simply turn the funds over to the United Nations or the NGO community or local governments and poor communities? Of course not. Our students would play the decision-making role. They would be co-creators of the change we want to see. For example, imagine classes offered in which a project included students who were required to make investment decisions aimed at ending world poverty, and they could be involved in actually overseeing these investments and really getting involved in these. One class might invest in a microfinance fund. One class might take a grant to increase the capacity of a community-based organization in a poor country. One class might buy food from local farmers to help stimulate local economies and reduce the food insecurity. They can help start the kinds of small and medium enterprises that Paul Collier spoke about. My own experience with today's students suggests that these kind of millennium development classes would be filled to capacities, because our students today do care about these issues of global poverty. So I think we can put together talent plus treasure. We know that our colleges and universities are filled with talented students and talented professors like Professor Collier, and they are also filled with treasure in the form of massive endowments. Let's combine the two, the talent and the treasure, and let the next generation learn about economics and ethics in the course of that, and literally work towards ending extreme poverty around the world. Thank you.
3 days.
I realize I'm the only guy between you and the break, so it's got to be more uplifting than some of the things we've heard. I was told to be uplifting. They set the bar pretty low. I would tell you, I'm supposed to do a little introduction of myself and then tell you some uplifting things. I've decided I have 4 of those things that might be uplifting, which will give us about 5 minutes apiece if I spend the next 3 minutes telling you who I am. In my day job, I've been designing primarily medical equipment for about 30 years. We put the first insulin pumps on diabetics. We got patients home on home dialysis equipment. We shipped our 140 million therapy for that this year. And I have about 350 really passionate, really hardworking engineers. We all have a day job. We work on what we think are critical issues to help the quality of life for a lot of people, mostly in the developed world, that can pay for medical care. For the last 15 years or so, about half of that time, we've done well enough that I've been putting an ever larger percentage of our resources over and above what it takes to run that business into projects that most people think are nuts. And I don't have investors, so I'm allowed to do things that are nuts. And I will tell you about a few of those projects now. Actually, one of them falls on the transition between nuts and just a good idea. We had to do something. It'll transition out of my day job, medical products, into, I'll call it, the remaining three: water, power, and FIRST. The transition project I'll tell you about, we were approached by the Department of Defense and DARPA a couple of years ago, who came to visit us and said, already 1,600 kids have come back from Iraq missing a complete upper extremity. A couple of dozen are bilateral. If you think about losing an arm, imagine losing both. Losing one then seems like an inconvenience. We were told that what the current state of the art is, basically, they put hooks on these kids and they send them through rehab. That's what they did at the end of the Civil War. There's not a big market for this stuff. The big medical companies don't do this stuff. I went home after listening to these guys and I couldn't sleep thinking about bilateral. So I put a bunch of people together, and I wish I could tell you more about it, and I'm really frustrated that I can't turn and show you a 2-minute video. You can go to websites and see this. But in 1 year, we built a 14 degree of freedom, fully articulated arm. Weighs 8.9 pounds, the same weight as the original equipment, 32 inches long, would fit on a 50th percentile female frame. We put it on some of these guys. We have various methods of interfacing the control. The neural stuff is pretty amazing. And the bottom line is, within the next 6 months after that, we had people that could pick up a glass, rotate at the wrist, the elbow, the shoulder, and drink from it. A few months ago, we had a kid that came in and was getting out of a troop transport, transradial on one arm, transhumeral on the other. Put it on him. Within a couple of days, he and a couple of guys were sitting up in New Hampshire. One, who hadn't fed himself in many years, was there with his wife doing something I can't do. He was eating cereal with milk with a spoon, and he didn't drop any of the milk. And his wife turned to me and said she hasn't seen him feed himself in years, so I had a choice. They keep the arm or I keep Chuck. So that has re-energized us to work faster, and we hope to put those machines on people for real soon. So, now, minutes. So now in 22 minutes, three projects that we're working on. I'll start with two that don't yet have the punchline. I don't know how they'll come out. I'm a technology guy. I see the world the same way all of you do. I see the same news. The news is pretty crummy most of the time, in part because that's what they like to report, but it's pretty hard to deny. There's a lot of crummy stuff in this world. And I always think of technology as a potential solution. It's the tool I work with best. And while I do mostly medical stuff, give you a piece of news on healthcare. If everybody in this room could think of every disease you could name, cancer, diabetes, Alzheimer's, MS, end-stage renal failure, just add them all up. They constitute 50% of all of human chronic illness. And they'll be solved one by one. We pour lots of money into them. We're solving them. All by itself, the other 50% of chronic human disease is bad water. You just heard somebody talk about the bottom billion, but it's almost 2 billion people now and rising that make a choice every day between no water or bad water. You heard what it does with food. Well, 20% of the GDP of the poorest 20 countries in the world pays for water that gets hauled around by women for 4 hours a day. Then they drink it, and 2 million people die a year, most of them kids. You look also, as you heard, that we've had major institutions since 1948 trying to solve these problems. They've spent literally $1 trillion. You've heard somebody else say it might now be a 19th century mind trying to solve a 21st century problem. I don't know about the politics and the economics. I can tell you it's certainly trying to apply a 19th century set of technologies. It seemed to me that with the right technologies, we ought to be able to get machines out to people to make any source of water pure. We ought to be able to run those machines in any local environment. So I started looking at different ways to do that, and while anybody can tell you, all the water experts in the world, if it's got salt in it, use osmosis membranes. If it's got cryptosporidium gerardia from surface water and bioburden, use chlorine. You put the chlorine in it, you'll kill all that stuff. It'll still have fecal matter floating around, it'll still be turbid, it'll still stink, it'll still smell. You wouldn't give it to your dog, but you might be able to drink it if you were smart enough and had the infrastructure to know where to get the chlorine every day and know how to titrate the right amount in. If you went to one of the 1.5 million deep wells, for instance, in Bangladesh that were dug so that you don't have to take surface water, you get below the bioburden. Unfortunately, you get into minerals. Around here, the mineral you get into is iron. It's that terrible stuff in our water. Leave spots on the glasses. The iron isn't in the minerals in most of Asia. The metal there is arsenic. It kills you. So you got to be able to take arsenic and inorganics and hexavalent chrome out. You got to be able to take salt out if you're near the ocean. You got to take bioburden out. I wish I had time to tell you how we do it because the technology is really cool. But we said we got to build a box small enough that it can be carried into any village, because about 900 million of the people that need this stuff are in small villages or peri-urban slums, as you heard. We set ourselves a goal of develop a technology that requires no membranes for salt water, no chemicals if it's bioburden, no activated charcoal or ion collection if it's heavy metals, because most of the places don't have Walmart at the corner to buy this stuff. And they don't have in the village the epidemiologist, the microbiologist, the organic chemist, the physiologist. They got to have something simple that's robust that works. So we set ourselves the goal of build a machine about the size of this podium that has two hoses on it. One you stick into anything that looks wet, a latrine, the ocean, a chemical waste site. Out of the other end comes water that would meet the U.S. Pharmacopeia standard for water for injection. And we built them. The goal, The goal was to make a machine that would last 5 years without a lot of maintenance and require no disposables. We didn't get a lot of support for trying the theory out, so I took some of my engineers, and we put them in Honduras for a month. Machine this size makes 1,000 liters a day, serves easily 100 people. Manufactured in high volume like a typical appliance, it would be a couple of $1,000 or less. For 300 million people in Africa, you need 3 million machines. You can do the math. It's pretty cheap. Even if you looked at all the power it consumes, it costs about 1.9 cents to make a liter of water. It costs 25 cents to move that around in bottles here. We thought that would be a good idea. The problem is, although it has all the magic I just told you, doesn't care what's wrong with the water, it does need something to run it. Electricity. But the poorest people in the world need electricity anyway. Not just to run this, but the two most basic human needs to get people out of poverty. Give them water and a little bit of energy. Not the kind of electricity we use, no jacuzzis, hair dryers. But in a small village, if there was just enough electricity, especially with LEDs these days, to give the same 100 people that would live off one machine enough power that everybody could have a phone, a computer, enough light at night to be safe, to read, to learn, to be on the internet, to get to truth, it would take a couple of kilowatts. So we took another neat old technology, and based on the time, I will not be able to explain how it works, but it's a closed cycle, hermetically sealed can, that uses any external source of heat, any external source of heat, solar photovoltaics, make electricity. Well, we don't need the photovoltaics. We can just take the sunlight. We can take cow dung. We built these machines. We made one, again, about the size of this, carry it into the same village, makes a couple of kilowatts, run on any source of heat. We moved two machines to Bangladesh, one 75 kilometers north of their capital in Dhaka, one about 75 kilometers west. A 20-family village and a 30-family village. And for 24 weeks, around the clock, these boxes produced enough power for these families for the first time ever to use electricity. Everybody had a little light at night. And the only thing that fed these machines was cow dung. And no sophisticated biodigesters. There was a pit next to the machine in each village with a plastic tarp over it. The natural biological decay of the cow dung was producing methane gas. It also produces carbon dioxide. That goes away. You can't stop that. It will end up there anyway. And a lot of carbon monoxide. Poison. It turns out that the way our combustors work, the methane and the carbon monoxide mix just fine along with moisture, go through the engine, work just fine. It turns out, by the way, methane gas by itself is 21 times as bad for the environment as CO2. And then it becomes CO2 anyway. If you collect it locally and feed the engines, you're protecting the global environment, you're getting rid of a source of disease in these places, and you're giving people electricity without taking any new source of carbon into the atmosphere. We believe you could probably build these machines at high volume at reasonable cost as well. We're working on a next generation of it right now. As I said, neither the water machine nor the electric generation system have a punchline yet. I'm one crazy lunatic, remember, doing this by myself in New Hampshire, and now even putting these things around by myself. But we heard that you don't like the solution from the right, and you don't like the solution from the left, so take the solution from the nut. Anyway, I'm going to tell you about one more of my crazy ideas, because otherwise this one's gone a little longer than water and power, as one of my, affectionately known by all my engineers, Dean's crazy ideas. But this one's long enough that I'll get some of you doubters. But it's the only reason I really came here, because this one's gone far enough that there's now a place for people, a focused, directed way for people to get it out there. And so whether I shamelessly grovel and beg for you to look into it, or by any other means, I'm not bashful or proud, I'll ask you to look at what FIRST is. How many people know what FIRST is? Not enough. Not enough. As I said, I believe in technology. In fact, by the way, our little water project, every internal project we have for all my big clients, which I can't talk about, has an internal name. The internal name for our water project is Slingshot. Somebody once asked me recently after we had him out in Honduras, why do you call it Slingshot? Because I have my whole life believed that technology properly applied is the leverage that gives people wealth, stability, happiness, raises the bar in every generation. And I guess I got that as a little kid by hearing the same fables as all of you. I guess I came away with a different, what was the moral of the story? I must have been a geek even as a little kid, because I remember, you know, the old story of the slingshot that killed the giant. And all I could think of as the moral of that story was, technology's cool. I mean, there was David, was this little guy. And besides, I was a little guy. My Hebrew name was David. But anyway, I was told that story, and I said, wow, so this little guy took out this really big problem, Goliath, with this little piece of technology. I think our little machine, the Goliath problem for 2 billion people is water. Maybe it'll help. But about 15 years ago, it started to really, really concern me that here in the richest, most sophisticated, most technically advanced and dependent society on the planet, we have a dramatically, and to this day, even since then, a very dramatically declining interest, particularly by women and minorities, in science and technology. And while I looked at what everybody's doing about it, because this is not like a subtlety, governments worry about it, teachers worry about it, parents worry about it, giant corporations that are worried about their next generation, everybody worries about it. But they all assume it's an education problem. Let's fix the schools where we spend $700 billion a year. Let's change this. It's more supply. You know, it's more standards, more tests, more this, more that, more that. In this land of plenty, I don't think so. And remember, I'm an inventor. That means I look at the same problem everybody else looks at and see it differently. I said, let's take the bold assumption that we don't have an education problem in this country. We have a culture problem. It's not that, and we don't have a supply problem, we have a demand problem, or a lack of it. The issue to me seemed like the reason this country is dramatically declining in the ability to create world-class scientists, engineers, and inventors, and almost no women and minorities participate in those, strive to even be part of that career base, it has to be because what our culture tells them. It's not what we don't have enough of, money, tests, standards. It's what we have too much of, a culture where every role model comes from the world of Hollywood or the NBA or the NFL. You can ask any kid, particularly in the inner city schools in this country, they can't tell you the name of a famous living scientist or engineer or inventor. How could they? You don't see them on the news. They don't see them on the billboards. So I thought, while everybody else is worried about it's an education problem and it's about supply, we should form an organization that changes kids' attitudes about science and technology and engineering. We should form a not-for-profit that will so compellingly show kids how exciting it is and how accessible it is and how rewarding it is to be able to think about problems and reduce the solutions to reality to make the world a better place and to enrich themselves. I mean, that's a much more realistic way to go forward than imagine you're going to bounce your way into the NBA. I go into these inner city schools and point out to these kids that there are more people winning state lotteries every year than the number of people that will ever make a nickel playing sports. The great American lie is not just that we have this obsession with our pastimes. It is depriving huge sectors of our kids from even having a shot at real careers. It's unsustainable. Last year in the United States, in the 20 largest cities, the 20 largest school districts in the United States last year graduated less than 50% of the kids due to graduate. This country is unwinding itself in a globally, intensively competitive environment that is in desperate need of great new solutions to energy issues and food issues and health issues. We sit around We're not fiddling while Rome is burning. We're bouncing and dancing. So make an organization that will leverage the obsession we have with sports. Turn science and engineering into a sport. Well, the only way that works, that'll ever get kids' attention, if they could see young, enthusiastic, world-class people doing it. You don't see kids playing cricket in the United States because there's no NFL or NBA of cricket. So there's no college cricket, there's no high school cricket, there's no junior varsity cricket. Well, if you try to show them science is cool without world-class young people that do it for a living, it's called a science fair. You look at my plastic paramecium on the folding bridge table in the basement of the middle school, and I'll look at yours, then we'll both go home and watch the Super Bowl, this million-dollar-a-minute production. And we'll bounce away 4 hours a day thinking I'll be the next Shaquille O'Neal. Where do women, where do young kids that don't happen to have professional parents ever get a clue of what their real options are? So I needed to instantly find young, enthusiastic scientists and engineers to put in front of kids. The teachers can't be the ones that inspire them. It's not the gym teacher that makes these kids work out all summer. The schools are for supply. Demand comes from our culture. We get what we celebrate, and we're celebrating the wrong things. So I'll now give you the quickest history of the development of FIRST. In 1992, I convinced 23 companies that get it, that have the big picture in mind, that they should find among them 23 sets of young, enthusiastic engineers, hopefully some would be women and Hispanic and African-American, to break the stereotype that all scientists and engineers are middle-aged, white male, frizzy-haired, German-accented sociopaths. And they should get these people to go to local high schools, and I would make a sport. And in every way, it's a sport. It's not like a sport, boys and girls. It's a sport. I gave them kits of parts. They only weighed about 10 pounds that year. Gave them 6 weeks, like every other high school sport. Gave them a kit in January. Said, come back for our event at the end of the build season, and we're going to have a double elimination tournament. Bring the cheerleaders. Bring the school bands. Your kids are going to run these robots, and you are Michael Jordan and Shaquille O'Neal. You people are going to inspire these kids and prove to them that if they're willing to exercise the muscle hanging between their ears, the world could be a different place for them. So, 6 weeks after I gave out those kits, these 23 sets of teams from all over, Boeing flew in from Seattle, TI, General Electric, General Motors, United Technologies. They flew in from all over with their kids, with the parents, with the teachers. And in one high school gym in Manchester, New Hampshire, we had 2 days of celebration of technology. At the end of it, I asked all 23 companies, what did you think? Every one of those set of mentors, the engineers, and some of them, their CEOs came, told me they thought it was the greatest experience they'd ever had. It was a win-win-win for everybody. The engineers were proud of what they were able to do, and they were community heroes. The teachers loved it because it wasn't yet another example of people coming in to beat on and complain about and blame the schools. The parents saw their kids change. It wasn't about building a robot. It was about building relationships between serious adults and kids and getting self-confidence into these kids and giving them a direction in a culture that's got so much noise in it, it's almost impossible. So I asked them, will you come back next year? Every one of those giant companies said they'd come back. And I said, well, look, you're all on the boards of other big companies. Bring your friends. The next year, we had about 60 companies. The next year, 120. The next year, 250. In the fifth year, still to this date, by the way, in our 15th year, we give out the kits. First week in January, the kits got bigger each year. Now they're up to 130 pounds. Now they don't play on a 12-foot square. They play on something the size of a basketball court. By the fifth year, we pretty much had every Fortune 500 technology giant, and I realized that with the sports model is going to work, we got to make this simpler and easier and more scalable, cheaper. So I asked all the big companies that had played for 5 years, that had seen the impact on kids and graduation rates and everything changing in the culture of these schools, look, you guys have to do regional events. So at the end of 6 weeks, you're not coming back here. Besides, there's no venue left in New Hampshire that can hold you. So we'll do regional events. Two companies that had been there from the first said, we'll do it. J&J said, we'll take over Rutgers University Fieldhouse. We'll do a regional, and the mid-sized and small companies there can adopt all the schools in New Jersey. Motorola said, we'll do the same thing in Chicago. From the fifth to the 10th year, we went from two regionals to 4 to 8 to 13 to 17. Our 11th year, oh, by the way, during that 5 years, we couldn't hold the finals anywhere, as I said, in New Hampshire. We held them at a little place called Disney. They built us, I wish I had ways to show pictures of this, Olympic Village of Technology to celebrate at Epcot. In the end of the 10th year, Disney said to us, we can't double the size of this place again. We're seating 20,000 people for a two-day event here. So in the following year, we finished 27 cities of regionals with all these volunteers, all these corporate sponsors, and we all went to celebrate at the Houston Astrodome. For the last 3 years, as I said, our culture gets what we celebrate. This country built a monument to what we value. We got to be the presenting sponsors of the 1996 Olympics, and we built for them the Georgia Dome. For the last 3 years, very fittingly, we finish our season. Still, we start in January. Still, we finish a month, 5 weekends this year in March of regional events. And for the last 3 years, we celebrate our finals at the 72,000-seat Georgia Dome in Atlanta. Our data for this year's event, which ended April 15th, 41 cities held regional events throughout March. Little cities like New York, Detroit, Chicago, Los Angeles, San Jose, Cleveland, Seattle, Houston, Orlando, Atlanta. Teams came from 38 countries. 71,000 engineers donated their nights and weekends to work with these kids. 13,911 schools had teams, if you count our little Lego League teams. It's all volunteer-driven. The good news is we've got over 1,600 high schools in this program now. The bad news is we got 25,000 to go. They need help. It takes people that give a damn to be mentors, to be supporters, to show what you value and what you celebrate. I've been told to be kind and gentle here. So I'm not going to tell you that every school needs an opportunity to participate. Only the ones you care about. Only the kids that you think you want to hand this country over to that are competent, that understand how to apply technology to the world's problems. The world's going to need water, and it's going to need power. It's going to need a lot of things. And as you've heard, 3 billion people live on less than $2 a day. A billion of them live on less than $1 a day. They don't have the resources to fix these problems. We do. We can squander those resources. We can try to hold ourselves apart and protect ourselves. Or we can lead the world. We can make it a win-win. I know we're going to hear Thomas Friedman, who pointed out it's not round. We're not isolated around the world. It's flat. We're all equal. It's not even flat. It's concave. We're all slipping into this bowl together. We can step all over each other and make it hell, or we can work together and create a world that we all want to have. It's going to take competent, smart people with good values that have the tools and the resources and the judgment and the vision and the courage to do something. You've got to give these kids the sense that they can do that and that the world isn't about instant gratification and bouncing a ball and entitlement and everybody's a victim. This country's got to change its culture. First, as a simple little organization whose goal is to change the culture of the country. It's working pretty well. Get involved. Go to our first website, or just hit the word first at Google, and we'll pop up as the very first thing you see. It's really fun. It works really well. It changes kids' lives. It'll make this a world you'll be happy to live in and proud to pass on. Thanks.